and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. No, scratch that. Hello and welcome to the Speculative Fiction Book Review Podcast, because today I'm not going to be reviewing a science fiction novel. I'm going to be reviewing a fantasy novel, and not just the novel, but a whole series, actually. So I might as well just get straight into it, because this is the second book review that I'm doing today, podcast recording that I'm doing today, so I think I've got all the news and everything out the way that I wanted to do. So, the series that I'm going to be reviewing is called the Prince of Nothing series. It's made up of three books, the first one called The Darkness That Comes Before, the second one is called The Warrior Prophet, and the third book is called The Thousandfold Thought. And I've read them all over in the past, maybe I started it about 18 months ago. I read the second book in the series just at the end of last year, and I thought, well, there's not much point in me waiting now to pick up the last in the series. So I thought, well, I might as well just read it. It's by an author called R. Scott Baker. I think he's Canadian, and this is his first fantasy series. I think that the first novel was his first novel, and it always happens like that you read sort of in the introduction, it always says yes, the first novel, sort of like 10 years worth of ideas going into it, and of course the second novel takes less time. The third novel probably less time, and it sort of does tell a little bit here. It's like the whole, like when you're in a band, you put all your best songs in your first album, and then you've got the second album, which is good, and then the third album, you're never quite sure what's going on. A little bit like that in this. So what I'd like to do is actually, first of all, like review the first two books and sort of the series as a whole, and then review quickly at the end about book three and what I didn't like about book three. And I know that's bad to say it that way, but overall I did really enjoy it. So let me open up my words here. Notes. So yeah, it's a fantasy trilogy. It's like set in a... the world of the book is got like 4,000 years of history. Year zero was when the humans came across the mountains from the other side of the world, and all the action takes place in a place called Irwa, which means it means the western part of the world, and then there's Aene, which would be the eastern part, I think. I'm not entirely sure, but I think that's the way around it goes. And all the action takes place around all the action in the books, in the sort of like in the contemporary world of the books, takes place around the Three Seas, which are like the southern area of Irwa. But there has been a lot of history taking place, and most of the history takes place up in the north, in the northern plains, and in the other mountain ranges and the other seas to the north. There was this other kind of race of people that weren't humans. They were called something else, but to the humans they were known as non-men. And they had a big battle in the past against this mysterious foe called the No-God, and there was dragons and orcs. Of course, they're not called orcs, but what happened was that there was a big apocalypse, and in the end, this wrapped up, this big apocalypse sort of brought into it, down into the world of men. That's the way I can say it. It brought into many different species into its sphere, but in the end, the men... the humans managed to prevail, and that was about 2,000 years in the past. And so since that time, all of the humans have settled down in the south. Most of them have settled down in the south and around the Three Seas. There's been lots of empires risen and fallen, lots of nations. For example, there's Conria and Setaidoni and Gelioth and Nansur and High Aenon. They're sort of all freer nations. They used to all be in one large... empire, but they're not really like that anymore. The only empire that's left is the Nansur Empire, and it's not actually very much bigger than any of the other nations. But the big empire, which has grown in the south, is called the Kian Empire, and these are sort of like the enemies of the north, mainly because the northern people have these different religions. They're called the Thousand Temples, and they have their own prophet who lived in a place called Shimmer and worked in a place called Shimmer. And then the Kian people take over, that empire takes over, and they have a different religious system. They're all like a monotheistic, and the other ones are not monotheistic, but some of them are sort of. They think that the gods are sort of aspects of the same god, or some of them think the gods are separate and different things. There's a weird kind of polytheism in the northern nations and a monotheism in the southern nations. However, what we really have here is a setup of the European nations in the north and then sort of like the Muslim nation empire in the south, because The book opens with the sort of the Northern Empire sort of squabbling among themselves in a little bit, but they're sort of united by their common religion. And in the south, you have this sort of monolithic empire which has taken over Jerusalem. Shimei is sort of like the Holy Land, but it's the Holy Land for both sets of religions or both sets of people. So what happens is the Pope, might as well just call him the Pope, up in Momen, which is say Constantinople, he decreed that they're going to go on a crusade and retake Shimei, cleanse the empire or the southern lands of the Muslim empire, the Kiyan empire, and that's it. That's what's going to happen. And in the first book, pretty much we follow the story of the gathering of the nations at Momen. Of course, it takes about a long time in itself. The second book, we have the crusade down towards Jerusalem across modern day Turkey. But it's not that. It's a lot bigger. The scale is a lot bigger. Then of course, the third book is sort of like the final part of the crusade itself. I'm not really giving away too much saying that because, once you're reading the first book, you realize it's a three-book story. It's going to take a long way to get down there. So that's sort of the overall story of the book. But of course, there's a lot more going on in the background. You've got the promise of the second apocalypse, which I might as well just introduce the first character or one of the main characters, one of the three. There's probably around about six or seven main characters who you follow the story throughout the book. One of the main one though is a guy called Drusus Akamian, and he's what's called a mandate sorcerer. There's different kinds of magic out there, but the mandate magic is the most powerful, but they very rarely use it. Now, what sets the mandate school apart is that they believe in the second apocalypse because their founder was given a prophecy that in the future there will be a new apocalypse, and when a guy called Anasurimbor turns up again, he'll be the herald of the second apocalypse. When he turns up, when the Anasurimbor, I can't remember the name now, when he turns up, the second apocalypse will be on its way. But nobody else really believes this except for the mandate schools of sorcery, because there's lots of other magic as well, different kinds of magic going on too. And the magicians, well, I wouldn't call them magicians, I call themselves schoolmen, because they get together into different schools, because magic is sort of outlawed by the different religions. So to get more power, they sort of ally themselves with like-minded people and set up these powerful what are called schools. And some of them run countries, some of them are outcasts, some of them do different things. But you read the book, you'll see there's quite a wide range of schoolmen. The second main character and the person who is who a lot of these books are named after, like it's called the Prince of Nothing series, and the second book is called The Warrior Prophet. Now, the Prince of Nothing and the Warrior Prophet is a man named Kellus, or Anasurimbor Kellus, and you might recognize that name. The Anasurimbor means that when he turns up, the second apocalypse might be on the way. And of course, at the very beginning of the first novel, he does turn up, and he's from this school. It's not as much a school, it's like this reclusive convent kind of thing that's been set up. Consent. I'm thinking back now to the world of what was the name? Anathem. So it's sort of like this place where people have taken themselves away from the rest of humanity to work on their own learning and their own things that they want to do. And it's also a bit like Dune in a way that they do their own, like a self-selective breeding kind of thing, where there's like a long-term genetic program to create the Übermensch, the Superman, the future Superman, and the super, what would you call it? The Messiah, the prophet, the new guy who's going to come in and unite the world. That was always the plan of the Kwisatz Haderach, or whatever it was called, in Dune. And that's what you have a little bit here, although the end is someone who will be able to have such a great physical presence and knowledge that they will be powerful and be able to sort out everything. I'm not entirely sure what's going on, because you don't really get a huge amount of detail, and it's all of the detail about the Dunyane is given in the first novel. And the second and third, it's sort of you know, is a continuation of what's happening. So the idea is, from the Dunyane, is they believe that before everything comes something else. There's always something that comes before. Now, most people don't really think about what's come before them, and so they can't really control their minds and control their needs and their desires and their selves and their personalities, because they don't really think about what's come before. A darkness has come before. Whereas the Dunyane think that something's come before, and if you can grasp this, and if you can understand what's come before in someone's life, you can say the right word at the right time and control somebody and do that. So Kelus is the epitome of this. He is one of the one of these long-term breeding knowledge people that come out of the Dunyane. But he doesn't tell anyone that, except what's happened is that he's been called by his father by some kind of sorcery, kind of long-range telepathy, that his father is down in the place called Shime, the Jerusalem place. And so he wants to go down there, and the Dunyane leadership send him down there to kill his father. So that's his main mission. Akamian, the sorcerer's main mission, is to stop the second apocalypse. And of course, as soon as he meets Anasurimbor Kelus, his sort of mission comes into focus as well. The third main character that we meet right at the beginning is someone who Kelus meets quite early on in the first novel. And he's a barbarian warlord called Kneira. I don't actually know how to pronounce his name. It's got umlauts in it in the wrong place and things. So, and he's this barbarian, and he actually met Kelus's father when his father came through the same territory in the same way. So while Kelus can control anyone else, Kenner has had sort of like the immunization shot of experience with someone else who was from the Dunyane school and knows how to put up with it. So what happens is that they travel together to go and kill Kelus's father. And Kneira wants to kill Kelus' father because he had a run-in with him in the past and things like that. But that's also, he's actually a quite an interesting character as well, because he's the only one who knows the full secret and knows how powerful Kelus is throughout the rest of the novels. Of course, there are other characters as well. The Emperor, I can't remember his name now, but the main Emperor in Momem, he's trying to stay in power. He's a new Emperor, or his line is quite new. His father was the first Emperor in his line, and his mother is still very powerful. And when all the armies that are going on this crusade down to the south gather outside his city, he has got a big thing that he has to try and, you know, keep them from sacking the city to get the food, and he has to keep feeding them, but he doesn't want to feed them too much to make them too strong. So it's his whole kind of, you know, the hordes of Europe outside the gates of Constantinople on the way to the crusades kind of thing in the first book. Unfortunately, in the second and third book, he doesn't have much showing because he stays behind, and I thought that was a real pity. However, his cousin, who you're not quite sure if it's his cousin or his nephew or his brother or anything like that, because you know there's massive hints, not even just hints, at incest with his mother, and not actually quite sure who else with. So that's a bit weird as well. What else is going on? Yeah, other characters. There's lots of like secondary characters. You've also got the female characters, like you say, the Emperor's mother. You've got a slave girl and a prostitute called Esmene, who is a bit annoying. But otherwise, you know, the characters are pretty good. And what else have I got here in my notes? I've got more about the world. Going back to these other characters as well, a lot of it is because there's a lot of history in the book, but he uses a lot of shortcuts, like saying, and this person looks like this, and you're just thinking, oh, okay, well, they're Northern European Norsemen kind of, and this person is like this, and you're like, okay, they're more sort of like slightly Oriental, or this person is more of a steppes kind of person, and this person, and this emperor is more sort of Roman Empire kind of thing, and I quite like that in the same way that Anathem uses these shortcuts to give, like, okay, this is this, and you're like, oh, okay, so you can just go through it. The characters generally quite engaging. I was getting mixed up with the notes here. I say all the secondary characters are quite well realized. Also, there's a lot of musings on philosophy in this series, and while it can get a little bit tiring sometimes, most of the characters have a basis for their philosophy. So they're sitting there thinking about, oh, I think this and I think that and I think this, and there's sort of like lots of talking about philosophy. So while their characters can sometimes feel a little bit too much like, ah, this is this kind of thought and this is this kind of thought and this is this kind of philosophy, it does work very well to give each of their characters a very solid grounding in a certain school of philosophy or a certain style of thought or a certain way of looking at the world. And then, of course, what happens to them and what they're doing goes, continues through in that way. And also, because for most of the first two novels and quite a bit of the third novel, although mostly in the first novel and the second novel, is that the viewpoints that we're reading about, the characters that we're reading through the eyes of, influences the writing in a very striking sense. Like, you could just read a bit and it doesn't have to say any of the names, it doesn't have to say the situation, but just sort of like the style of the writing and the discourse of the philosophy there, it influences the writing, which I found quite cool. The problem is, once you get past the first sort of tier and second tier of characters, the third set of characters is just so many of them, and a lot of them have similar sounding names and they're from similar places, and also some of them will be mentioned at one point and then they won't be mentioned for another 400 pages, and then they'll suddenly pop up in a battle and do something decisive or get killed or something. You're like, oh, wait a second, who is this? And you're trying to remember the name and you're thinking, there's a glossary at the back, but you don't want to interrupt the flow of the writing. So sometime I found the battles, just because suddenly there'll be a new character introduced and you're like, aha, there we go. So that can be a bit strange. However, my main problem with the characters is the main character himself, Kellus, and Sarimbisabor, whatever his name is, because he's a complete, like you say, he's the Ubermensch, but he's a complete and utter psychopath and sociopath. He's a fascist dickhead. I don't even know how to say what it is, because he's like completely self-serving as well. So everything he's doing is trying for his own benefit, and he doesn't seem to. He like pretends that he cares about people and tells them what's come before in their lives, and exposes their weaknesses and their strengths and gives them courage and helps them along the way. And he's doing everything, but everything that he's doing is just to build himself up. Even though he's saying, "Oh no, I'm not. Oh, stop calling me the prophet. Stop." It's like he's just. It's so one-dimensional. I mean, it's an interesting character just to have someone sociopathic and just so psychopathic and so controlling and everything. But it's an impressive feat of making someone completely and utterly unlikable and then making them the main character the second main character. In a novel. I mean, it makes you be able to have a look at a certain philosophy which you don't normally get so much in novels or in fantasy or science fiction that I've read anyway, so which makes it interesting. However, like I say, I never quite know what he's wanting. Is he just wanting to get down and kill his father? Does he want power? Or which one does he want? Because it's like throughout the second book and the first book and the second book and the third book, it's like there's so much going on there, and I'm thinking, well, he keeps getting more powerful and it's good and it's interesting to see his rise to power. But then I'm thinking, what does he want? His motivation is never clear except to be the powerful one, and it's not that compelling. However, the other character, like the other main character, which is Achaemenion, he has got a very compelling story. It does get a little bit repetitive at times, but what he gets up to is very interesting, you know, and his journey that he goes on and his trials, he actually has something that he needs to fight against and go through, whereas Kellus is just, like I say, too one-dimensional, which is a bit pity. Moving on to the action and stuff in the novel, which is, I was just wanting to make a point here. The first novel is purely very close viewpoint, limited viewpoint, third-person narrative, which was very, very interesting to read through, like I say, because of the different points of view and the different ways that you can read it and the different philosophies of the different characters. And then in the very last passage, or the very end passage of the first novel, suddenly it became like third-person, unlimited, omnipresent, completely knowledgeable kind of narrator, just to show that just to show the armies moving away from Constantinople. And I was like, ah, that was quite a nice turn from the very intense, up close, personal, in the heads of characters to this much wider view when the armies start moving, and that was really good. Then the second novel, what happens, you get a lot of the close viewpoints, but then you get these huge, wide vistas telling of the action in the battles, and it concentrates on this battalion did this, and this army did this, and this general did this, and it's not very much, there's not many gritty details. You don't really get down and spend time with an individual character. It just says, this person struck down this person, and this went, so it gives it a great sense of history. In the third novel, well, I'll get onto the third novel later, but it doesn't... the magic system as well, which I normally talk about science and technology with science fiction, but the magic is very well thought out. It's not directly explained in book one, but I sort of worked out what was going on. Two styles of magic, one direct, one which works via abstraction. Yeah, I can sort of understand what's going on here. Demonstrated, though, I mean, it's demonstrated a tiny little bit at the end of the first novel, but you really get a good demonstration of the different levels of power in the magic and the way it works, and not the way it works, but, you know, the style of it and showing how it works in action. And when we see it in action, we get this wizard on wizard kind of fights, and there's lots of description, these clever, cruel touches, and that's really, really interesting. The third novel, well, I'll get onto the third novel later. The writing, it's all about long passages where characters think hard about philosophy, like I said before, and I really enjoy those. Like I said before as well, because the entire novel is structured around cause and effect and what comes before what else, the writing style really does that too. So you get them thinking about the causes, and then they do something which is the effect of the cause later. And then the next time you meet up with that character, they're thinking about the causes, they're thinking about this, and they're thinking about the philosophy, and they're thinking about the causes, and then something will happen and they'll react to it in the same way. So I actually quite like the way that the writing plays in. And it's also quite poetic as well. I'll just open the book. I turned over some corners here, so I can't remember exactly what I'm opening up to. But there's I just want to read out a passage just to show the kind of the language when they're talking about the philosophy and how it brings into it. And this is from the page 35 of this third novel. I can't remember. I turned the corner over here, but it might not be the thing what I'm talking. Oh yeah, I'll just read this bit out as well. Talking, Knair is looking at a child, and he's wondering why the Dunyane, the Anasurimbor, Kellus, is wanting to keep the child. And it gets him thinking. He goes like this: there was no interval in the world. No, let me start that again. There was no interval between the world and an infant soul. No deception, no language. An infant's wail simply was its hunger. And it occurred to Kinnear that if he abandoned this child, it would become an Enrithi. And if he took it, stole it away, and rode hard for the steppe, it would become a Salvendi. And his hair prickled across his scalp, for was the magic in that, even doom. This wail would not always be one with the child's hunger. The interval would lengthen, and the tracks between its soul and its expression would multiply, become more and more unfathomable. This singular need would be unbraided into 1,000 strands of lust and hope, bound into 1,000 knots of fear and shame, and it would wince beneath the upraised hand of the father, sigh at the soft touch of the mother. It would become what circumstance demanded, Enrithi or Salvendi, it did not matter. And suddenly, improbably, Knair understood what it was the Dunyane saw, a world of infant men, their wails beaten into words, into tongues, into nations. Kellus could see the measure of the interval. He could follow the 1,000 tracks. And that was his magic, his sorcery. He could close the interval, answer the wails, make souls one with their expression. And so that's just a piece pretty much picked at random. And the whole of the first two novels are like this, and most of the third as well. And you get these really interesting ways of looking at philosophy, even though the philosophy isn't that deep, or it can be deep and it can be a bit thick, but not sort of like not thick as then dense or hard to understand, but sort of laid on a bit thick. But the language that he's using and the writing style that he's using, I find quite mesmerizing, even though it's like, yeah, okay, he's had this dream before, but just the way it expresses the dream in a different way, it's like, okay, he's had this thought before, but in a different situation, in a poetic way. So I do really like the writing and the kind of style of coming across action and bringing things into each other. Another thing about the writing as well is that there's a lot of sex and a lot of violence. It's very gritty. But in, like I say, in some places there's this epic feel as well. So you can get really gritty stuff, but then the next page will be suddenly a huge sense of history and a sense of import and everything. Bring it down here. The themes of the novels as well. There's a whole lot of things. Like I said, it's a lot about the philosophy, and again, I don't really need to go into that now because I think I've brought out those different themes, or talking about the different themes of history and philosophy and power and lots of different stuff. But again, this is like three sets of or three 700 page novels to talk about the philosophy and the themes, and I can't really go into that much detail about them right here just in this one podcast review. So as a conclusion, if this was just books 1 and 2, it would be like a perfect fantasy set of novels, because it does everything that I want it to do in a way that I want it to do, and it's got these interesting twists to it as well. For example, the completely unlikable character of Kellis and how he does it sort of strains credibility that he can get away with stuff as he does and win everybody over onto his side, but it's interesting what's happening, what's going on. So I'd give it like 4.5 stars if it was, like I say, just the first two books. And if the third book fulfilled the promises of the first two books, it would be like a 4.5-star trilogy very easily. Except for the third book, like I just said. I finished it a few days ago, and it started out really good. Like I said, that passage that I read out there was from page 35. Although it's page 35, there's like a 70-page, or maybe 50 pages before that called What Comes Before. In other words, sort of like filling you in on what happened previously. And then the novel starts, and it picks up where the last one left off, as you expect with this series as well. You know, there's not a lot of gap between the two novels. And things happen, and blah, blah, more of the same. However, you start wondering, you know, going into the world, yeah, I'm thinking, okay, we had this... exploring the world in the first book, this fantastic epic journey of the start of the crusade in the second book, but then in the third book they pretty much get to where the destination is, like to Jerusalem, quite easily. I mean that's where they're heading at the beginning of the book, but we don't really get anything more of the world. And I'm thinking, well, what's there to explore now? We know all the players, we know all the characters, and there's just nothing more that you find out except stuff that happens in the past. However, we actually have, because there's so little to talk about and so little to do in this third book, we actually have a character sitting down and reading a book and then thinking about the history and, oh, look, this is what happened in the past. Oh, yes, it's very interesting to read this book, isn't it? Yes, it's very interesting. Oh, this was what happened in the past. Oh, yes, what happened in the past. But it doesn't play into the novel at all or anything like that. And it doesn't have the same feel as the first two novels. Now, I don't mind this happening, because this is what happens sort of in, like, say, a book like The Lord of the Rings, where, you know, you get a lot of the history come through and they tell stories, but it's never like, oh, and this character sat down alone and read this book, and this is what they read in the book. And then they close the book, and now let's go elsewhere to this action over here. And it's like, well, that's not interesting, and it's not needed, and it didn't really expand on the world very much. Unlike, like, the first book was great world building, the second book was like this, like I say, this epic journey and really built onto it. Next point, the plot. And there's really not a lot to mention. Like I say, the first 50 pages is what comes before. And then, you know, they walk a bit, and they do this kind of stuff, and Achaemenion, he moans a bit, but there's no new knowledge coming in. And the big promise of another great conflict, which was at the end of the second book, where, like, the second apocalypse is sort of starting to be unveiled, and there's this big sort of thing coming on. You really feel like this big, like, another dimension is coming into it. So it's not just about the crusade. It's about the threat of the second apocalypse. Then you get the big battle at the end of the book, and then I'm thinking, okay, wow, this is only maybe 150 pages left. This has got a lot to wrap up. And I was thinking, well, maybe we'll get the beginning of the second apocalypse coming in, and then we can sort of really ramp it up. So if this is the end of the trilogy, it really sort of ends on this note of doom that they've been fighting among themselves, and what they should really have been doing is fighting or getting prepared for the second apocalypse. And you do get that throughout the book. And then I turn the pages, and there's just a bit of a strange thing, and I'm like, oh, what's this character doing this for? And I'm like, well, it's a bit strange, he's not done that. I turn the page, and it's only page 484, and suddenly it goes, encyclopedic glossary. And I'm thinking, what, that's it? And that's the end of the book? And I flick through the end because I was caught out by this before. If you remember my review of Ian M. Banks's Matter, he puts the glossary, and then after the glossary, he puts, like, the prologue after the glossary. So I was, like, flicking to the back. But no, there we go. On page... Let me just flick to the end of the book here. Page 624, Z, and we get... and all the different Z names, and there's a lot of them, so it gets quite confusing as well. But yeah, it's got this, so we've got like page, literally, what is that, 140 pages of encyclopedic glossary at the back. And I thought that was going to be plot. I thought that was going to be character. I thought that was going to be world. I thought that was going to be conflicts. I thought it was going to be all the things. I thought it was going to be philosophy. I thought it was going to be all these other things that were in the novel, in the first two novels, and then it just ended. Now, how it ended was quite interesting in a way. It was an interesting scene in a way, but not any more interesting than most of the scenes in all of the first two books, which was, again, very, very disappointing. So, like I say, this is a big battle, and then it just ends, and the main threat of the second apocalypse just isn't dealt with, and it doesn't say, to be continued in this next book, and it doesn't say, oh, what will happen in the future, and it doesn't do that. It just stops. And it's literally, I was thinking, this is like Lord of the Rings. There's this big battle of, what is it, the Pelennor Fields, Eleanor Field? I can't remember what the name of the big battle is, but you know, in the film as well, it's the big battle, and there's the big Oliphants, and they were doing all this kind of stuff. And just imagine if the film stopped there, and they didn't bother carrying on with Frodo's story about actually destroying the ring, and it just goes, and there's the big battle, and that's it. And you're like, is that it? And they're like, yeah, that's it. And you're thinking, well, maybe there might be another one, but they never even says. It's sort of like, this is the third book in the Prince of Nothing trilogy. And so, of course, that I know there's another book coming up, but it's like, it was just wholly unsatisfying in every way. And I was literally just going, is this it? Is this the end? Because it's like, okay, they go down and there's a big battle at the end and that's it. But there's so much stuff that didn't pay off. Stuff that they wrapped up as well. Wait, let me put it this way. He did wrap up storylines, but in a very not interesting way. For example, there's these things called the Skin Spies, and you realise they're part of the Consult. And it was a big threat in the second novel, and then it's just dropped in the third novel. I mean, they're there, but they're not a threat anymore. It's like, oh, that's not important. We're just going to finish up the Crusade story. It's like, oh, okay, like that. And Kellis going off to find his father. And he does find his father, and I don't want to give it away, but it's probably one of the most disappointing ends. And again, I can sort of see what's going on there, and I can sort of see what R. Scott Bakker is going for in writing such an ending and writing the conflict between Kellis and his father, but it just wasn't good at all. And then there's the story of Knair, the barbarian. He just goes off and does stuff, but then he's sort of like absent. He's in the novel, but he doesn't have any impact at the end of the novel. However, biggest problem is that I never believed that the Crusade wouldn't win in the end. This big Crusade going down, and they're doing this, and Kellis is slowly getting more and more power as well, and I never believed that Kellis wouldn't win either. As a protagonist, he's never had any trouble. He's never had a worthy antagonist at all. He had sort of one in the first novel where he met Knair, and Knair sort of saw through him, and he was like, okay, I know what's going on there. And he managed to sort of, you know, get through that and sort of win out against Knair and get more power over Knair. And that was an interesting battle. And in the second novel, he's trying to win over the entire Holy War, like, to, you know, he's trying to control it, and he's trying to get people onto his side. And he actually had people that he had to fight against, the Skin Spies, the Emperor, well, not the Emperor as such, but the nephew of the Emperor, and all these other big political players, and he's having to go up against that. And in the third, he didn't have any trouble with anybody, and he went up against his father, and he didn't have much trouble there. And then he went up against some of the sorcerers, and he didn't really have much. And I'm just reading it thinking, well, it's not very interesting. He's suddenly become way too powerful. And I think And in the first two novels, he was this power, and he had this promise of this power, but it was never fully fulfilled. And when it is, it's like, well, that's not... Again, it's just not interesting. And yet, to create some kind of sense of danger and some kind of, like, chaos or some kind of, yeah, sense of danger, like upping the stakes, he just kills off random main characters. Like, oh, this person can die, and that person can die, and that person can die as well. And it's like, but you're not you're not making these deaths mean anything. When they do die, it's like one less thing to worry about, rather than one thing that becomes more treacherous, or it's sort of like just thrown it in there. It's like, oh, well, we'll kill off this person. Oh, okay, kill that person. It's like, it doesn't mean anything when the killing is seems to be there just to either bring out a sense of nihilism or a fulfillment of what's come before in their characters, but it didn't add anything there as well. And also, while the glossary, I actually quite enjoyed reading the 150-page glossary, because it fills in a lot of bits of story, it gives away too much. In the end, it gives away too much about what happened before at the beginning. Like, all this stuff which was a mystery, all the things that are legend about the first apocalypse and things that happened before the first apocalypse and stuff that happened between the first apocalypse and now, and all these different things that you were always, like, hinted at and referenced in the actual novel. Then it's explained, this person did this, this person did this, this person did this. And, like, and I almost wish I didn't go through and read any of that, because I really wanted to... You know, it's more interesting to find out about backstory in the plotting and in the characters and what they learn, rather than literally just having a glossary when it said, actually, you know what happened? This. And I don't like that. I like to tease things out. I mean, I posted on my blog an entire essay. I think it was like 7,000-word essay, a paper on some characters in the Bible, with my own theory about the history of the patriarchs in the Bible and their shared identity and stuff like that. So I actually really, really enjoy this kind of thing, of this sort of like text criticism or source criticism or whatever you want to call it, of actually teasing out the history and the words and the attitudes of the ancients and all this different kind of thing out of the text itself. And actually quite, even though I enjoyed reading the glossary, I feel like I've been cheated a bit, or I've cheated myself out of future enjoyment of the following series of this book. Also, in the second book, the characters, no changes the third book, no changes in the characters in the third book. There was like one change of one character, and then the other characters were just doing stuff, and I couldn't see the motivations of why suddenly this person would turn against that person, or why this person would suddenly do that. And then sometimes I did see it, but it felt really forced. It didn't really feel right in any way, which is a real pity. The magic, and I mentioned this before, what I really liked about the first book is that the magic was hinted at. And in the second book, the magic was demonstrated. And in the third book, it's explained the workings of it in minute detail, and it killed the magic. Well, it killed the magic of the magic. I want some mystery to the magic. It's like science fiction. Again, it's sort of like sometimes you'll read about how something... you'll read about a bit of technology, and you're like, oh, that's cool, that's really cool. And then you read how the author thinks it should work, and you're like, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And in this novel, it does make sense, but I actually... And it is actually, it's very close to how I thought the magic would work. But again, it's one of those times where you just don't spell it out. And it felt like R. Scott Bakker was trying to pad this novel by just going, okay, and this is how this works. Oh, and remember this? This is how this works. And this person opened this book and they read this chapter. Here is that chapter. And then they close the book. You know, it seems to be padding out this novel because there's no plot and the characters didn't do anything as well. Also, the writing, I had real problems with the writing, especially of the final battle. Now, there's this great review that you should really watch on YouTube about Star Wars Episode 1, the Phantom Menace review. I think I mentioned it before on the podcast, but watch it anyway. It's a really great, it's like 70 minutes. Watch it, and it's very interesting. Now, he picked out on something which I also noticed about the Star Wars movies, is that in the first Star Wars movie, Episode 4, there's like one thing happening at the end. It's Luke pops the thingy down the what's it and blows it up. In the second one, there's two things happening. Luke is having a fight, and then Han Solo and Leia and the Chewbacca and all those kinds of, they're escaping from the Cloud City. And in the third one, there's three things happening. There's Luke having a fight with the Emperor and his father. There's the things happening down with the Ewoks and all that kind of stuff. And then there's also a battle taking place on the Death Star, and it all comes together and it all works out and it's good. And in the fourth one, in the fourth film made, Episode 1, so it gets confusing, doesn't it? There's four things happening at the end, and it's too much. It's like there's too many conflicting things happening, and it just takes it one step too far. And I noticed that, like, when I was watching, even when I watched all of these films, because you can sort of see the progression there, and it makes it interesting and a complex ending. You've got more to root for. It's like, if you don't really like Ewoks, well, Luke's and his father's story is good, and you get the death of Luke's father, of Darth Vader. Not giving anything away there, am I? Hope not. But then, so that's you've got that kind of sad part there, but then you've got the triumph elsewhere, and you know, Lando, he gets his redemption at the end after being a traitor in the second film. Then he gets back and he wins, and you get all these different things coming together really well. The end battle of the Thousandfold Thought, which is, you know, the third novel here, you suddenly, unlike in the first two novels where it's either close in on somebody or when it gets to a battle, everything going wide and you see everything as a vista, suddenly you get this mismatch of the two where Kellis is doing one thing, Akamian is doing another thing, and yet there's a huge battle taking place at the same time. For what I can tell, absolutely no reason whatsoever. There's no reason why these three things have to happen at the same time, and yet they do happen, and they're cut between each other really, really quickly and really annoyingly. In the same way, if you've read A Brave New World, in the opening part of A Brave New World, you're getting to know the people, and they go through the decanting factory and stuff, and at the end of it, it goes, this person doing this, and it skips quicker and quicker through three or four different viewpoints of people going through their day and doing stuff, and it just gets quicker and quicker until you get, like, a sentence of this person, then a sentence of the next person, and again, at the time, you sort of see why they're doing that, but it seems to be doing it for the sake of it rather than any reason, rather than any plotting reason or expression or any thematic kind of thing. And that's what really happens here at the end of A Thousandfold Thought, they really go work against each other for any kind of dramatic pacing, and it's just really bad. I mean, it's just not well done at all, because you're thinking, well, what's happening here? And then by the time you get to the battle, it's like, oh, something else must have happened, but it's not been written about, and suddenly another army turns up, and then another army, and then this army does this, and then this army joins in, and then you go away and you do this person, and then these people are having sex, and then that person's, you know, doing this, and then back to the battle again, and you're going back here, and that's happening, and then this is happening over here, and then you go back to the battle, and it just doesn't, again, it doesn't work. And also, while the battle's in the second book, because there isn't any big battles. I mean, there is one big battle at the beginning of the first novel, but then in the second one you get some good battles, and the language is fresh, and because it's quite epic, and it stays with the action. It happens here, and then it happens there, and it happens here. But now, because we're skipping from one thing to another, he has this trick where he ends each of the sections of the battle with almost. Well, I wouldn't say it's like an identical line, but it fulfills the same purpose to sort of give a sense of dread and epicness and this other stuff in the end. So I'll just read some of these out. It goes, "The Sake Grandmaster's blood was blown like sleet across his back." That's the next one here. I'll just turn the page here. "The slaughter was great." These are whole paragraphs, one-line paragraphs to end. Here we go. "Cursing the fool, the Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires stepped into the smoke-rent sky." Next one here. I'm going to just turn the page. Here we go. That's this way. "Death came swirling down." Let me get one here as well. Oh, I can't find it. "He saw the broadsword that took his head. His corpse toppled into the burning tracts below." What's one here? "Horse and man thrashed black in descending fire." Do, do, do. Let's see if I can find another one. "Absolute darkness engulfed them." Do, 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 do. "There was no escaping the warrior prophet's holy light." Do, do, do. Oh, that's it. So all of these different things, it's just this sort of standalone one sentence of this did this, and that did that to that. And this did this. And it's just like, I get the trick. I see the trick that you're doing here. And I didn't really see the trickery in the writing at the beginning. And it sounds good. And it's nice writing. But it's sort of like the battle suddenly becomes transparent. And it's just going through the motions. And I didn't get that in the first two books at all. Whereas here, it seems to be very much going through the motions. And not good at all. And like I say, I lost all of the closeness of the characters. The you know, like you say, the very close third person narrative, limited narrative. Sort of, it gets, you know, you lose any of that kind of sense of immediacy and threat that you had in the first two novels. Which is, it's like I say, it becomes formulaic. So What have I got now? I've got a final note here, and I can't read it. Well, I can read it, but I can't understand what I'm trying to say. Oh, yeah, here it is. So what I do is I know there's the new book of the second trilogy is coming out, set in this same world. Apparently the events take place, it's sort of like the events taking place 20 years after the events of this book, which is interesting because I would have thought there's probably would have a lot happened in that 20 years, but maybe nothing does. But anyway, that's the idea. So what I do is suggest read the first novel. Great. Then read the second novel. Great. Don't read the third novel until you get the third novel of this novel, or the third in this series, and then the first novel of the next trilogy at the same time, and read them together. So the disappointment that I found in this book, because it's this novel, because it's shorter than the first two, ends in a really unsatisfying place, and all that kind of stuff, and leaves lots of things unsorted, unresolved. Just read this book and then immediately pick up the next book in the series, which I've not read, by the way. But do that anyway, so you don't get that sense of disappointment. So that's what I'll do. And don't read the appendix either. Only read the appendix at the end of the last novel set in this world. Which, to be honest, it might not just be two. It could be another. I don't know how many novels it's going to be, but it's probably going to be at least another three novels. So you'll probably read six novels and then go back and read the glossary, the encyclopedia at the end. Because, like I say, the glossary was good, but I really enjoyed it when there's complexity to the history. Like, the Mandate school thought one thing happened in the apocalypse, and another school thought this happens, and other people think that. And then when it's all just laid out, it's like, no, this happens. It's not very interesting. Destroys the sense of mystery, which is very bad. So, anyway, overall, 4.5 stars for books 1 and 2, taken as a unit. And if I just pretend that I didn't read the third book, I could probably keep it in a much higher regard, but like the third book really, really let it down. So I think what I need to do is check out, like I say, the next series. So I'm probably going to read that. I'll read it. I don't want to read it straight away because I've read these fantasy books, and I've got lots of other novels that I want to read as well. But I will definitely pick it up again. Mainly because if I think this is the end of anything, it's really bad. Whereas the journey to get here was really, really good. The journey has been a lot better than the destination, if the destination is the disappointment that I felt and the frustration that I felt at the end of the third novel. So that's it. Anyway, if you like this novel, this series, or if you like the sound of this, again, I keep forgetting to do this, but it does remind me a lot of other big epic series. Of course, there's sort of similar bits in Dune, and of course the Lord of the Rings as well, which you can't really take any remove of that. But also there is these elements mentioned as well, and I don't want to actually tell you what other novels that you should read to sort of give you an idea what might be going on, because it'll give away some of the secrets. Because even though I've talked a lot about the plot and the characters and what they do and this and that, There's lots of other stuff going on which I haven't mentioned, because there's always half a book that I don't want to spoil, even if I've said what happens at the end. In some ways, there's a lot more going on here with the subplots. Read the Neverness series, the Requiem for the Homo Sapiens by David Zindel. You've got a similar kind of lots of philosophy and lots of looking into human psyche and human brains, and then sort of with a character going through that who's the only person who can control his brain, and he tries to attain godhood and things. You know, similar kind of stuff that you want. So go for that, and yes, that's it. My next novel that I'm going to read, which I've already finished, is Ian Banks' Transition. So I'll be reviewing that. I was going to read it today, but I took a big break between reviewing these first two books. So I'll probably review that tomorrow once I've finished my notes. Otherwise, email me if you've enjoyed this review, if you've got any recommendations, or if you want to disagree with my thoughts and or anything with the Prince of Nothing series. So, my email is luke@juggler.net. You can also follow me on Twitter. Go to @LukeBurridge or twitter.com/LukeBurridge. Also on Goodreads, you can follow my reading habits and schedules. And as I'm going along, I put comments, not at the moment because I've been away at sea and don't have internet access, but generally I keep up to date there as well. And also, I read the updates on there too. So if you're also my friend, if you become my friend on goodreads.com, I see what you're reading, and any comments that you write write about the books, I pick up on them there as well. The other thing you can do is follow me on my blog, read along on my blog, which is lukeburge.com/ blog. And also my own fiction. You can read my novels as well. I release them for free online. You can download them and read them. So do that, because I think they're pretty good, and other people think they're pretty good as well. Better than this book that I've just... No, put it away. It's better than the second half of part 3 of the Prince of Nothing series by R. Scott Baker. All of my writing is better than that. Anyway, I'll catch you next time, and thanks for listening.